You can support this podcast at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia.
This episode is brought to you by
Sock Club.
They're delivering the perfect gift experience. Quality American-made socks sent straight to your loved one's door, featuring different designs and a personal note every month. This is the gift that keeps on giving. The patterns are stylish and fun, just the right splash of color, even in your most serious business suit. Go to sockclub.com and get 15% off using discount code CRIME at checkout. Give Sock Club this holiday season.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is Crime Writers On, the podcast about other podcasts and also about journalism, pop culture, true crime. And this week, we're back after a whole bunch of stuff went down. We'll get around the horn for all the latest true crime updates about Bo Bergdahl, a potential serial season 3, my trip to visit the Undisclosed crew, and more. We'll also get into one of the most popular new crime podcasts out there, Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams? Joining me to get that done is the host of These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast, my true crime co-author and real-life husband, Kevin Flynn. Hello, Kevin.
Rebecca, just because we were off the air for 2 weeks doesn't mean you should leave the house for 2 weeks and leave me alone here.
What are you talking about?
I was
about?
Very lonely.
I wasn't away for 2 weeks.
It was not that long.
And also joining us is journalist, true crime author, former defense investigator, licensed PI, certified cat lady, on her deathbed this evening, Laura Bricker. Good evening, Laura.
Thanks, Rebecca. You inspired me when you were sick and you went on, so I'm taking one for the team tonight.
Yeah. The show must go on.
Exactly.
And finally, it's our favorite naysayer, the amazing noir novelist, Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Howdy there, little lady.
Toby, you been watching Westworld or something?
No.
Shucks, ma'am. Twernt nothing.
I realized I didn't have any foreign language
things. That sounded pretty foreign to me.
I just thought I'd say something like somewhat offensive.
Little lady. Well, Toby, speaking of offensive,
what the hell?
It's the holiday season. It is the holiday season. And I think some listeners have actually been doing their holiday shopping with the Amazon link at crimewriterson.com.
They have.
In fact, listener Heather Wilson told us she did $750 worth of shopping with our link.
Thank you, Heather.
So, Toby, I was wondering, would you like to highlight any of the items that our listeners have purchased using the Amazon link at crimewriterson.com?
I could.
All right, do it.
Give us some sexy music first. That's it.
Because if there's something that's sexy, it's Uncle Milton Ant Farm, Live Ant Habitat, Light Up Gel Colony.
Hot.
Wait, does it come with ants?
Yeah.
It's unclear.
You usually have to like send away for the ants, I think, right?
They don't elaborate in the product description. All right, number two. Frank Sinatra Carlton Cards Ornament Swingin' Sound of Christmas Crooners Series.
All right. No
sure
idea what
that
means. Sounds very...
Is it a Christmas ornament? Is that what it is?
It's either a card, an ornament, or a CD.
Oh.
A Mopah, which is copyrighted, Petty Perfect Foot File, Electronic Pedicure Tool,
ooh.
Regular Course Blue, also available in pink extra coarse.
Ah, it's one of those like hand sanders that you get at Home Depot, but it's made for your heel.
I actually really need that.
It is.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
I was going to get one for my husband. It's actually, he has horrible feet.
Ooh.
Laura, have you ever tried that stuff called baby foot where you like smear it all over your feet and like all the skin peels off several days later?
You know what? I actually showed that to my husband and he was like, that's really bad. That's so bad for you.
It's awesome.
And I'm like, I mean, it was kind of freaky.
Yeah, it's fun, though. Try it out.
Yeah, you guys are stepping all over my segment.
Okay, carry on, Toby.
Move aside.
Annie's Homegrown Organic Bunny Fruit Snacks Variety Pack, 0.8 ounces, 24 count.
Clear. God love Annie's.
This is a disaster. I also recorded these like without the peanut gallery.
I like this version better.
I emailed it to you a little while ago. All right. Exploding Kittens. Not Safe for Work Edition. Explicit content.
Wow.
What in what category is that?
Toys and games, of course.
Hmm. Exploding Kittens?
Food.
All right. And then pet supplies. Y Song Archetype quail formula canine feline diet, 7.5 ounces.
That's for when your dog is like really messed up digestive issues and can only eat very specific types of meat.
Is that what it is? I just thought it was interesting that you could feed it to both cats or dogs. Denon AVR X2300W 7.2 channel full 4K Ultra HD AV receiver with Bluetooth.
Was that the most expensive item on the list, Toby?
Yeah, that's a good guess.
Yeah, I think it was. You know how I know that? Because I sorted them by price.
By price.
I was like, we need to get Toby to read some of the high-end items, inspire our listeners.
Well, I resorted them by category because it's easier to go through that way. And then I resorted them again by price because...
So I should do like the A, B sorting, first category, then price. I'll do that next time.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, I can sort.
Well, thanks to all of our listeners who did do some of their holiday shopping using the Amazon link at crimewriterson.com. Go to our website right now. Get the rest of that holiday shopping done. You will be supporting this podcast when you do it. It doesn't cost you anything extra to do that. So thanks very much, Toby. And thanks very much to our listeners. So, Laura, something interesting happened a week or so ago. You and I almost had a run-in in a foreign city. Not foreign, but a different city other than the ones that we live in. How can you explain to our audience how that happened?
Well, I happened to see, I think on Twitter or Facebook, I was flying into Pennsylvania, actually Baltimore, to go to Pennsylvania for a family event. And I saw that you were still in the airport. You were eating crab cakes. And I was like, ooh, I love crab cakes. So I was like, hey, are you still in the airport? And you were in like the gate, maybe two gates up from me. So I went running along, but I saw the line going onto the plane. So we literally missed you by 5 minutes. Wow. And
didn't you notice all the paparazzi that had gathered?
I'll be honest with you. We actually were like, we had like an A30 seats. We were in the way back of the A line. So we weren't actually in the line when you walked by. We were at the Pinkberry frozen yogurt stand.
Did you see us running by?
I can't believe I didn't. You were probably like right behind us running by. It was a really funny run-in. I do love the mini crab cakes at the Baltimore airport. Shout out to them for those mini crab cakes. I was in Baltimore for an event having to do with Undisclosed. I was there for the live.
Tell us about this. I mean, you walked out of the house and I didn't see you for days.
That's true. You didn't. So, as you guys know, I sort of have this remote relationship with the Undisclosed crew. I've never actually met any of them before. They were doing a live taping of their addendum show around their season two case at the New America Foundation in DC. And they invited me to come, and I kind of wanted to meet John Cryer, so I decided to go. And it ended up being amazing. I had dinner at Rabia Chaudhry's house, and Justin Brown, Adnan Syed's attorney, was there, and his initial attorney, Chris Floor, was there. Susan Simpson was there. All these like unbelievable people were there. Of course, John Cryer was there. Rabia was there. And
Colin couldn't make it, huh?
Colin couldn't make it. Mr. Beans the cat was there. And then the next night, Mr. Beans is pretty rad. He loves white people, as it turns out.
What the fuck does that even mean?
Rabia was, people were sort of chasing. Everybody wants to hold Mr. Beans. And he's just like a little bit, you know, people trying to chase a cat. Like, they don't typically like that. And she was like, John, Rebecca, you go get him. He loves white people.
My God, Rabia has a racist cat.
I don't think he seemed to love all the people there. But yeah, it was really great. I have to tell you, it is one thing to sort of know people from a project like Undisclosed or Serial. Rabia Chaudhry, I don't know if like you guys know this, is super duper nice. Like, she is not 100% the character she pretends to be on social media. She's sharp, quick-witted, you know, sassy, all that stuff, but also really, really warm, really, really nice. And John Cryer was pretty rad. It was fun to meet him. So it was a fun week.
So you got to meet all the people that are the voices on those podcasts. And earlier in the week, the four of us got together from this podcast. I want to know who drank more alcohol.
Toby.
But us as a group, the four of us.
Oh.
Not that big crew in
Rabia
Baltimore.
Is Muslim, so us, for sure. Okay. She doesn't drink any alcohol. but Susan and Dennis Robinson and I, you know, gave the four of us a run for our money. But I think that when the four of us were all together, I think Toby and my Moscow Mule Palooza probably set the new record.
And there were a lot of people who came who were fans of Crime Writers On and had nice things to say about
I'll tell you, one thing that happened that was so weird was that when we were at the New America Foundation for the event, at one point, I wasn't working. I was just there. But I was backstage, you know, with all the people. And then I sort of walked out into the audience just about to start. And people started clapping, like, when I came out, as if anybody, like, I was like, what are you clapping for? What just happened? And I met super fans of this show, like, super, people who don't listen to Undisclosed, but listen to our show, who came like hoping that I would be there or that one of us would be there.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. They exist, guys. They exist. It was incredible.
Well, big shout out to Washington and Baltimore for representing.
Yeah. We should do an event in D.C. It would be fun.
Who would have thought this time of year, which is usually pretty quiet, would suddenly explode with all these true crime podcast updates?
There are so many. What, Kevin?
True crime podcast updates.
All right, Kevin. So we've got a big list of stuff to talk about. I'm going to start out with you, Toby. The Bo Bergdahl case. There was a very public call to give the serial season 2 subject Bo Bergdahl a pardon. Do you want to tell us about where that came from and how it's being received?
Sure. It was in the New York Times on a Sunday. I guess it was last Sunday. It says New York Times editorial. They start off by kind of giving a little bit of background, and then they talk about how Trump had called him a dirty, rotten traitor in New Hampshire, and it kind of said in the old days he had been executed. And so then they asked the question, how can he get a fair trial in the military justice system when the next commander in chief has proclaimed his guilt and accused him of treason? The short answer is he can't. They go on a little bit more, and then the final paragraph is where they get to it. It says, there's an alternative to a potentially drawn-out legal fight over Mr. Trump's incendiary remarks in the Bergdahl case. Mr. Obama could issue a pardon before he leaves office. That would put to rest a prosecution that was questionable from the outset because Sergeant Bergdahl had pre-existing mental health problems when the Army granted him a waiver to enlist. He emerged from captivity deeply traumatized after 5 years of being subjected to physical and psychological torture. It is time to let him rebuild his life.
You know, we were watching this on Twitter, and we kind of threw it out to our listeners. Okay, what do you think? And while there were some people who said, you know, the prosecution should continue, most people seemed to be, they were okay with the idea of a pardon. Maybe not so much because they're absolving all of Bo Bergdahl's actions, but maybe also just to kind of like just put an end to this, especially when it looks like, you know, he may spend a couple of months or up to a year in jail when he already spent 4 years in captivity.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I know I work in journalism. This is one of those things that I feel uncomfortable necessarily like giving my strong opinion on. I do think there really is, though, something to the idea that it would be difficult to have fair proceedings given the rhetoric around him and given the person who's now sent into office. I mean, I covered the event on the web. You know, we had reporters at the event where those comments were made. And certainly if I were the defense attorney in this case, I would be asking for the same thing.
They seem to repeat a lot of what we heard James Weirich say and the concerns of the defense team.
Exactly, exactly. Now, Laura, true crime update from you. Brendan Dassey, what the hell's going on with that poor kid?
This poor kid. I mean, I just feel so bad for him. So Brendan Dassey was actually set to be released from prison. You recall his conviction was overturned in the summer by a lower court. And then less than 48 hours before he was set to be released, a panel for the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit granted the state's emergency motion to stay the order that would have had him released. There was no reasoning in the order. It just said, you know, granted. So we don't really know what went into that. And it said basically that this is stayed pending appeal. So who knows how long this is going to go on now. His attorneys posted online afterwards, "We are disappointed more than words can say. The fight goes on." So the prosecutors in the case filed their challenge soon after a judge on last Monday ordered Dassey to be freed no later than Friday at 8 p.m., In the ruling granting his release, the judge had stated that Dassey didn't seem to pose a danger to the community and he was not likely to run away if he was released. So now he's going to remain behind bars, remain in jail while the state appeals his overturned conviction.
Well, what really blows me away is the emergency stay. What is the emergency that requires that this poor kid be kept in prison? Like, what is the emergency there? Like, what's the consequence if he gets let out?
No, it's ridiculous. I mean, I just feel so bad for this kid, but it is ridiculous because there wasn't really any, they just filed, it was a very basic motion. There wasn't really any detail. It was just, you know, stay the release pending the outcome of the appeal.
Now, Kevin.
Well, the emergency is because he's about to be let out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not emergency, something terrible is going to happen. It's emergency, it's going to be out in 48 hours,
yeah.
So you got to hurry up.
Of course, emergency just means the timeline, like we only have this much time. I get that, but they really just seem very bound and determined to keep him in prison, like really determined, like there's something in it for them to keep him there.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably they feel it's their duty. I mean, I think and like you said, you were quoted in a really great article in a recent issue of Standard Issue Magazine talking about these wrongful convictions. And I think you're right. I think a lot of the prosecutors and the cops that get up every morning and go to work don't feel like, you know, I'm going out today to screw somebody. They think that what they're doing is right and within the bounds of the Constitution. Sometimes they just get it wrong, but they also feel like this is my duty to make sure that this happens. So I never sort of like think, oh, well, this is being vindictive that the state is moving to oppose bail for Adnan or for Brendan Dassey. I don't see it as a personal thing. It's part of what their job is, although the rest of us probably disagree with it. It's just sort of the way the wheels of justice move. They do not turn fast.
Well, if you think about, though, the way the justice system is set up, and this is something that came up, actually, at the addendum taping, Dennis Robinson, who is on the undisclosed team, is also
a JAG
attorney. Yeah. And he just made the really good point that the criminal justice system is set up. Sometimes the officials are elected. Sometimes prosecutors and judges are elected.
Right.
Sometimes they are, you know, it's appointed or it's their job. The whole system is set up and tallied by wins, not tallied by justice. It's not tallied by truth. It's tallied by wins. How many cases have you won? And that determines whether or not you get reelected or reappointed or, you know, or whether or not you get to stay in that, you know, prosecutor job because you work for a DA who might not want you if you don't tally up a lot of wins. That is what the system is based on. And as Laura has said in this podcast many times, these are competitive people who take these jobs. But that's what the system is built on. You know, it's unfortunate in someone like Brendan Dassey's case that is the scoring system because they could end up winning on appeal if they take it to appeal. But they also know that keeping him in prison gives them an advantage on appeal. I mean, there's a lot of data to show that, like, if somebody is in prison, they're not out. Their trial outcomes are not as good, typically, if they're incarcerated during trial.
Yeah.
So, Kevin.
Yes.
You have an update.
Yeah, mine is on the podcast breakdown and the Justin Ross Harris case. And first of all, can I just say, Bill Rankin has really grown on me.
Wait, you didn't like him to begin with?
No, I should say that. No, I would say I thought he was fine and he was like, this is good for a newspaper guy. But I really think he's kind of found his voice. And he really found a very interesting case in the Justin Ross Harris case. And as you recall, this is the trial about a man who left his 22-month-old son Cooper in the back seat of his car on a hot day. And while he said it was he forgot about it, at the same time, he also had this double life where he was sexting and was doing all sorts of
gross,
deviant sexual behavior.
Gross,
yeah. I mean, stuff that would make, you know, that would certainly make him come off looking like a creep. So that he was charged with several counts. In addition to, there were like related counts. There were counts that were related to the sexting because one of the people that he sexted was a girl who was under 16.
Yep.
And, you know, it's yet to be known whether or not he knew that or whatever. But that was part of the trial. He was charged with felony murder and malice murder,
right,
which is the harsher charge. So the jury came back and he was convicted on all counts, including malice murder.
Yeah.
And as Bill Rankin said, you know, sometimes the law has some poetry in it. And in order to get a conviction in Georgia on the malice murder charges, the defendant had to act with malice in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
What's really interesting about this whole case has been that it's not a whodunit. It's not whether we got the right guy. It really comes down to his intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Did he intentionally leave him in the backseat of the car so that he could get out of his relationship with his wife?
No. Sorry, was that me saying what I thought?
Yeah, you know, I Rankin was very even-handed. And what I liked about this podcast is it wasn't just a recap. I mean, it was a lot of buildup and a lot of background in the law in the case before we even got to trial. The venue was moved, and so we lost the whole summer, and it came up again in this fall in a new jurisdiction. But it wasn't just a weekly roundup of what happened in court. It was certainly, you know, longer quotes, much more context,
Great experts.
Great experts to talk about really what's going on.
Really good explanation about legal inside court proceedings. And also a lot of interesting case investigative details, like that cop who lied, changed his story.
There was an awful lot that sort of poisoned the well about what this was about, because
right.
there were things which, again, the cops backed off on by not bringing up at trial. Things like saying, oh, he was researching how to live a child-free life. There
right.
was a thing on
not
Reddit.
True. Yeah.
Not true. There were text messages, and the things that were attributed to him were actually things that people were sending to him. They moved very quickly as far as putting some bad stuff out there.
Right.
Absolutely. Is he a creep? Absolutely. Do I feel like after everything I've listened to, if I were on that jury, I would have convicted him on the murder charges? I don't think so. You know, this is a common enough tragedy that they run public service announcements in Georgia to remind people not to do this.
Right.
And so if you're going to criminalize this one case and not say it's all the other ones are accidents, but this one is criminal because he was doing other things that were either illegal or at the very least despicable, then, I don't know. I mean, if I got into a car accident with a baby in the back seat and the baby was killed, that would be an accident. If I were drunk when I did it, I could be charged with vehicular homicide.
I'll tell you what my issue is with it, is that he liked the girlfriend experience. He liked to have a lot of sex. Who cares? It doesn't make you a bad father. It doesn't make you a murderer. A lot of good parents aren't good at their relationships. You know what I mean? I don't like how the relationship and like the violation of what's seen as the norms of a relationship are brought into the right or wrong of other facets of somebody's life. I just don't think it's okay.
I guess I have a hard time like figuring out how you could, without a reasonable doubt, put yourself in that person's mind that he decided to do it. You know what I'm saying? I just don't know how you could be so confident that you would know his intentions, that you would be able to convict him.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only way you get to that is because of this other stuff. He seems like the kind of guy who would have. Because beyond that, they wouldn't want me on as a juror on a trial where it basically all hinged on what somebody's intention was, because I don't think I would ever feel real confident in that unless he like wrote it down on a piece of paper what he was going to do or something. In
right.
which case, it's not just trying to figure out his intention. He left evidence.
Right.
So that to me is a tough one, and it doesn't make me feel good to know that he was convicted of that, just in that it seems like you have to make a few leaps, and it's the kind of leaps I wouldn't want people making if I was on trial for something.
You know, I'll just give you the two big pieces of evidence, the one that would lean towards guilt and the one that would lean towards innocence. One of the details that they brought up was that after lunchtime, he had purchased a bunch of light bulbs from Home Depot, and he went back to his car. He opened the door to his car and threw the bag of light bulbs in. And there was a lot of examination, and the jury wanted to see the videotape again, trying to determine whether or not, through his line of sight, whether or not he could have seen into the back seat. The original cops had said he had stuck his head like all the way into the car, but the video showed that he did not put his head into the car. But that's sort of a question there that I think that the jurors, based on sort of the questions that they were asking, thought that that was damning.
Right.
The piece of evidence to me that says, I don't think this is what was going on, was the fact when his ex-wife testified. Very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, if you listen to only one episode of that podcast, listen to that one. She was somebody who was cheated on and embarrassed and humiliated in front of the world, and still does not believe, and still the cops were still kind of winking that, well, maybe she's still a suspect.
Right.
You know, they weren't really playing fair with her. She said their relationship sexually had cooled off, and that there were problems in the marriage. And at one point, and this wasn't after like a fight where there were dishes broken and whatnot, she just turned to him and said, do you want a divorce? Now, if the prosecution's case is the only thing standing between Justin Ross Harris and his life of debauchery is the fact that he is married and he's got Cooper, the idea of, I need to kill Cooper so that I could, he's already doing all the stuff he wants to do.
He was bringing women to his house.
He was already doing all of that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
The wife just gave him a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he wants to leave that life, He's got the open door. He doesn't need to go to the lengths of killing his son that he appears to love very much.
Right.
So that's the thing that swung me. I thought that that was, you know, more powerful than the other evidence. And I will just say, to wrap this up, as a father, I'm horrified, but I can see myself doing something that absent-minded.
Hey, Laura, how many times have you been driving someplace and accidentally, like, made the wrong turn because you're so used to going someplace else?
Oh, I've done that, especially if I'm listening to something on the radio or if I'm having a conversation. I'll be like, oops, I was supposed to turn there, and I'm still driving down the opposite. Yeah, I've done that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, we just get stuck in these patterns, and that's, you know, how it goes.
Yeah.
All right, so one final true crime podcast update. The Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago a couple weeks ago, Julie Snyder from Serial was there.
I remember that name.
And she gave a talk, and she talked about some of the production stuff behind Serial. She talked about, you know, why Serial Season 2 was so different than Serial Season 1. And she also broke some news about what the Serial team is planning. So it turns out we are going to get our Serial Season 3 next summer.
Mm.
But before that, in March, which if you look at your calendars, will be here before you know it, we're going to get a Serial spinoff, an untitled project scheduled to launch. It's a 7-part podcast about a man who despises the Alabama town he's lived in his entire life and tries to do something about it. It involves a murder investigation that leads to strange relationships and a hunt for hidden treasure. So I did a little digging. I found some historical cases of some possible hidden treasure in Alabama, but I have a theory.
Uh-huh.
I could be crazy. My theory is that somehow the podcast, the real-timeness of it, may lead to listeners looking for a treasure.
When you say hidden treasure, do you think they literally mean hidden treasure?
I don't know. I mean, there are stories now in the United States. There's a guy in Texas who has a treasure that he's been trying to, like, he's been dropping clues, trying to get people to find.
Yeah.
There's this guy, John Willie Smith. This was a historical case I found. Apparently in Alabama, before he died, buried $100,000 worth of gold. So people think the gold could have been buried anywhere, perhaps in different locations. But maybe this podcast will spur a real-life treasure hunt, and that would be freaking cool.
I think maybe they're looking for One Eye Willie, the pirate's treasure chest, and the three of us get that, but because Toby has never seen Goonies, he has no idea what we're talking about.
Sorry, we left out of that one, Toby. Toby, what do you think of this story idea, and do you think my theory could hold water, or do you think I'm being crazy?
I think it would be cool, especially since my in-laws live in Alabama, and I could go down and visit them.
Ooh.
And go digging for treasure. That guy in Texas, I think, has gotten into some trouble in that some of the clues have led people into fairly dangerous situations.
Mm-hmm. Like a Pokemon Go?
No, I mean, like, you got to go up this mountain and look
across
under
these train
rocks
tracks.
And stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think I read an article about that.
The easy to find hidden treasure is never worth it.
So, Kevin, what do you think of this idea for the Serial Season 3?
I really like it. I wonder who the host will be. You know, the voice of it. So much of Serial's particular tone is Sarah.
I have a theory
Sarah.
About that, too.
You do have a theory?
Yes. I'm going to say it's Starlee Kine. And the reason
from
I,
the mystery
from the mystery show.
Show, which is
and the reason I
the
think
air.
That is because I know that Starlee Kine is now a consulting producer on Season 3 of Serial as well.
Oh.
I read another story where they've brought her in to help work the story of that season because she has a really gifted story craft person. I think she is going to be the host of this Serial spinoff. That's my guess.
Well, I like it, and I can't wait for us to spend 7 or 8 weeks talking about what they're doing at the offices of This American Life. The only issue is that when you take any story, it's always a roll of the dice, whether it's going to be something good. You know, talking about rolling of dice, it's just like playing Pass the Pigs by winning move games.
Pass the Pigs.
It's the classic game of chance from the 1980s. It's still around.
That we all have now.
I know. We've all been playing Pass the Pigs. Players roll. If you've never done this, players roll 2 pig-shaped dice.
That's all you gotta do.
And they score points on how they land. Now, Rebecca, if the pig lands on his nose, what's that?
I don't remember. I look at the box every time.
It's a
leaning jowler.
It's a snouter. It's a snouter. 10 points. How about 2 pigs on their back?
A Kevin Flynn?
Oh, shut up.
It's a double razorback.
It's a double razorback. Yes. And you can just keep rolling. Just don't get piggish. Because you could roll the pig out and lose all of your points. This is a great party game. It's perfect for adults. It's good for kids. It's good for the whole family. And Pass the Pigs is an ideal holiday travel accoutrement and a delightful stocking stuffer, too. Ready for this? These pint-sized porkers pack a big punch.
I do love a game that doesn't have a lot of stuff. And this game is like you could put it in your purse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's got a great origin story.
Really? Tell us. No, tell us.
They wrote it up. It's in the little brochure.
Oh, I didn't see that. Okay, so
it's like the people of Piglandia or something.
I'm going to call
you and Jack Pigfellow.
Ah.
They're the spokespeople of Pass the Pig. I don't know.
So Pass the Pigs is available at toy stores everywhere, but for a special 20% discount, visit winning-moves.com and enter promo code CRIME now. So that's winning-moves.com. And promo code CRIME for a 20% discount.
Oink, oink. So, guys, there have been a ton of new true crime podcasts that have premiered this past month. We will eventually get to all of them, especially now that we have to wait till next summer before Serial Season 3. But we know there's only so much we can listen to, so we're going to take them one by one. The CBC has come out strong with a podcast looking at the unsolved murder of an Indigenous woman in a small fishing town. It's called Missing and Murdered. Host Connie Walker shows us her investigation and names in the 1989 case of Alberta Williams. The crime is set against the backdrop of Canada's infamous Highway of Tears, where more than three dozen women have been killed or have vanished. Of course, Missing and Murdered was a Toby recommendation. But before we talk about it, let's hear from someone who spent a little more time thinking about this story than we have.
My name is Connie Walker, and I'm the host of Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams? And I'm also a reporter for CBC News in Toronto.
And you are also an Indigenous woman.
That's right. I'm Cree from Saskatchewan.
Now, one of the things I want to ask you about right away is that you do really bring your personal story into this podcast. And we can talk about, you know, the story a little bit in a second, but was that hard, you know, telling your personal story and making that personal connection to the story when that's not something typically journalists do?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for sure. And it's absolutely, you know, not something that I would do in a regular CBC News segment for television or radio. But I think the podcast format kind of gives you the space to kind of weave those kinds of things in a way that it felt like, even though it was a difficult thing to talk about and to bring in, it felt like it was natural in some ways as well.
You do say at the beginning of the podcast in episode one, you say, you know, sometimes you choose a story and sometimes a story chooses you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you were talking about? That this was the right story for you to tell, that you could tell it differently or maybe with a little bit more, I don't know, personal, more of a personal touch than another reporter might be able to do?
I feel like I said that this is the right story for the right person at the right time for a number of reasons. For me in my career, I'm at the point where I was feeling comfortable to include that. But also, these stories are just starting to be told, that for a long time, there was no interest in hearing about missing and murdered Indigenous women. I remember pitching my first story about this issue 10 years ago when a girl that I knew from back home had gone missing. And I heard about her disappearance in an email chain that her family and community was sending around trying to get attention. And it was the same summer that a young, blonde, white woman from Markham, Ontario went missing. And her disappearance was covered all over national news. It was in the newspapers and on the newscasts. And there were so many similarities between these two disappearances. But Amber's story wasn't even covered by the local news at the time. And I remember pitching a story, because I was working in it in the national newsroom at the time, pitching a story about these two disappearances and kind of examining the way that the media covers these stories. And my executive producer at the time said, "This isn't another poor Indian story, is it?"
Huh. And oh, my goodness.
Yeah, there was no interest. And so I never did that story. But now, 10 years later, it's been my beat, which is a terrible thing. But for the last 2 years, I've been exclusively focused almost on telling stories from Indigenous communities, but in particular, stories of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada.
Now, your podcast is framed around the murder of Alberta Williams. She was 24 years old. She went missing in 1989, and 3 weeks later, her body was found. You begin the story by talking about how it came to you. You got a tip from a former cop who was investigating the case, who's now retired. It was interesting to me, you know, a lot of true crime stories, they open with the victim or they open with some aspect of the crime, the discovery of the body. You open with an investigator who is frustrated, and, you know, really determined to continue to help, even though he's no longer actively on the case. How surprised were you to, right out of the gate, have this incredible source to tell this story?
I was shocked because, you know, I have been reporting on other cases that are unsolved. And in those instances, like, the RCMP won't tell you anything, essentially, than what they would put in a press release. You know, this person was last seen here. They were wearing this, like, very basic details. And here was an investigator who had, you know, who probably knew the most about this case than anyone and was speaking freely about it. I was so surprised when he sent the email and then when he agreed to talk to us about it. It was something that I certainly would never have expected to have happen. And it's been a really interesting story because it also runs counter to the narrative we always hear about these cases, because we've done a lot of reporting on how the police do not take these cases seriously, the cases of missing Indigenous women or women who have died. Sometimes their cases are closed, their family feels prematurely, or closed and deemed a suicide or no foul play suspected despite really suspicious circumstances. So I've done a number of those stories where families criticize the police. And here was kind of, you know, the opposite of that, where there's this former investigator who's now retired and 30 years later is still thinking about this case that he was never able to solve.
That was one of the things that has really been sticking out to me, is that we do often hear, especially I think the current narrative of some of the better true crime podcasts, are about how the police haven't done their due diligence, or about how prosecutors haven't done their due diligence in pursuing the truth and pursuing justice. It sounds like, for the most part, this investigation into Alberta Williams' death, I mean, I think you have uncovered a couple of holes, but it does sound like it was worked. They did their door knocking. They interviewed suspects. This wasn't one of those things, you know, as we heard in The Dark, if you've heard that podcast, where, you know, you have found one person who was never interviewed, but it wasn't one of those things where, like, nobody was interviewed. This is a cop who took diligent notes. You know, there are multiple people working on the case. It sounds, though, when you're telling the story, the longer thread about the missing and murdered Indigenous women, that these cases aren't typically pursued. So how big a problem is this? Like, how many women are we talking about, and over what period of time?
Well, I mean, that number is up for debate. I mean, the RCMP, which is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, had issued a report a few years ago that said there were 1,182 women in a specific period since the 80s, I believe. But advocates believe that number is actually closer to 4,000. And it's, you know, a huge issue in Canada that's been underreported for decades. And now there is a national inquiry that's just ramping up here, trying to get to the bottom of the root causes of this issue and why this is still continuing to happen in Canada. But just getting back to your point about this, this seems like a case that was really well investigated. It's really interesting because Gary Kerr, the police officer, not only did he want to do an interview with us and tell us about this case and about how they worked this case, but he actually also gave us access to his police notebooks
from
the time.
That blew my mind when I heard that. That blew my mind. Because I'll tell you, police notes, as you say in the podcast, are the most valuable thing to look at when you are reporting or writing about a crime, because they were there and you can really get inside their head and get their reactions. And that was really astonishing.
It is astonishing. So we have these notebooks that he wrote, like notes that he wrote from the time from Alberta's disappearance to months and months after her body was found, when they were still looking at certain things. And that's actually the focus of the next episode, because we didn't have a chance to really look at them while we were out there talking to people. Like, people just started coming forward and we kind of just kept pulling the thread or the yarn. And we ended up where we end up in episode 6. But in episode 7, we actually go back and in depth read through Gary's notebooks, what we can actually read, because his writing is atrocious. Like, we sound like we're learning to read again when we're actually trying to read some of his notes. That's partly why we got him to do the voice memos and read them for us. But we are able to, you know, kind of uncover some things that were a bit surprising for us, I think, when we took a second look at his notebooks. Obviously, hindsight is 2020, and you know, here 27 years later, you know, certain information has bubbled to the surface that maybe when you are an investigator on the ground in 1989, you know, there are so many other things that you're looking at or looking into. But it's interesting to see what did or didn't get investigated based on his notebooks. And the other thing about the notebooks is that because this is an open investigation, you know, this police file is open. And so the RCMP on the record won't tell us anything about Alberta's case and where it's at now. But the one thing that's interesting is that the RCMP officers keep their notebooks after they retire because they might have to testify in an unsolved case. And investigators who are working on Alberta's case right now, if there are investigators working on Alberta's case right now, they don't have access to Gary's notebooks.
They only have access
to the police file. And anything that was, you know, submitted from his notes that made it into the police file. But there are some things, I'm sure, that are in his notebooks that aren't in the police file right now.
Are you a TV and a radio reporter? Do you do reporting across both media?
Okay. Well, I'm mostly television, but I have been doing radio in the last few years.
One of my favorite things that reporters are doing in the podcast medium is they are explaining how journalism works. I mean, there really is something that separates a DIY, you know, true crime storyteller from a journalist telling not just a true crime story, but really any story. And you deliberately explain why you can and can't do certain things or why you're making certain choices. You talk about going and talking to the journalistic standards person at the CBC. You talk about why you bleeped out a suspect's name early in the series. And you also talk about why you can't share some of the information that Gary has sort of given you access to, you know, the crime solving ethics around that. Are you enjoying being able to infuse this story with some journalism lessons?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I would approach it in any other way, because, I mean, it's definitely rooted in the journalism for us. I mean, we were working with our CBC News colleagues, obviously, in the investigative unit on this podcast. So it's definitely rooted in the journalism. And it's been interesting, though, because I think for so many of the investigations that we've done in the past, it's all focused on the end, right? CBC News has learned X about a specific case or about a specific story. And the thing that I love about the podcast format is that the journey is part of the story and that we can be transparent about what we're learning is unfolding. And that's something that's kind of scary on one hand, because, you know, you're being transparent in a way that journalists typically aren't, or maybe we've assumed people aren't interested in for whatever reason. But it's also exciting. And I it's going to be weird after the podcast is over to go back and then, you know, file a regular report for The National, for example, or which is our national newscast here at CBC. I mean, I don't know if I can say I've been enjoying it, because it's been a very challenging story on so many levels. But I, you know, I have been enjoying aspects of it for sure. But it's hard. I've never done a radio documentary before. So why not 8 in a row, right?
Why not? Now, how real time is the reporting in the podcast?
Well, we started ahead, but we wanted to be able to respond to things as they came up. So we started with 4 episodes complete. And then we've had this kind of buffer as the weeks have gone on, which has rapidly diminished. So now we finished episode 6 today, and it's going out tomorrow. And we have gotten some new tips from people who we hadn't heard from before the podcast started airing. So we're actually going to take a week to pause and take a look at some of those tips and see how and if we can incorporate them and where they lead us for the last few episodes.
So this part of the process, very often when you're reporting a story for TV, this is when you're finding out if there's there, but you already have content out there. And
yeah.
So you're discovering that as you go. Are you terrified there's not going to be any there when you get to the end of this?
No, I'm not terrified. No, I mean, I think that part of this story for me has obviously been about Alberta's case and trying to find out the truth about what happened to her. And if there can be a development, that would be amazing. But the bigger part of it has also been about the bigger issues of missing and murdered Indigenous women and kind of helping people connect the dots about why this is such a horrific phenomenon in Canada and where those roots are. And so I already feel like, you know, throughout the process and in the various episodes where we've been able to kind of provide the context that people need to understand some of these bigger issues, you know, I listen to Serial, I listen to other podcasts that don't like wrap things up in a little bow. And I think that's okay for me, at least. And I hope it's okay for our listeners if that doesn't happen. Obviously, it would be amazing if it did. But I think I have to just think about the bigger picture a little bit when I think about where we're going to end up.
Well, one huge advantage you have, too, is that you're taking us places we wouldn't otherwise go. And most of us are never going to fly in a tiny plane, you know, to northern Canada.
I wouldn't recommend it.
I have one question for you about detail of the case. Now, we hear you talking with Gary, and he's telling you details of the crime. He talks about Alberta's cause of death being horrific, that she had a horrible death, and he says that he can't give you the cause of death, at least on tape. To me, that sounds like the cause of death is either unique in nature or evidentiary in nature, that the cause of death is actually something that would help solve the case. Were they able to have a good suspect? I mean, do you know the answer to that question? Is it unique or is it evidentiary? Is that something that you can speak to without getting into any of the details that you can't share?
You know, that was really interesting because Gary didn't want to tell us about it, but it had been reported in other places. So I wasn't like, I didn't know where that information had come from. So I don't actually know, you know, if for him that was considered holdback information or not, but I don't think that it was. He didn't explain, at least, why he wouldn't release that information to us at the time. But I did see it reported in other places, the exact cause of death. And so it's been a bit of a weird line because we have this police officer who is our primary source for the criminal investigation not confirming that and wondering how and if we needed to include it. I think that what we were able to include was relevant and gave people the information they need about Alberta's death, but that's something that still is a bit of a mystery about why he wasn't forthcoming about that in particular.
I think it's interesting. And I think it really kudos to you for not including it because you couldn't verify it. I mean, it's not, I think that sometimes people don't understand that because something has been reported, it doesn't necessarily mean either that it should have been reported or that it's true. I mean, it also depends on what the source was and so forth. Another thing that Gary says to you on tape that we hear in the podcast is that his theory of the crime, he believes Alberta's death was a one-off killing by the person he believes who killed her, that it was perhaps an unintentional death. And he made it sound like perhaps after a sexual assault or something that it was sort of like, to keep you quiet, I have to kill you. But he believes that person has not been violent again. After doing the reporting that you're doing, are you finding more evidence to support Gary's theory of the crime or to refute Gary's theory of the crime?
Yeah, that's tricky because we in our investigation, we are uncovering things that Gary and then Rick, who's the other RCMP officer who worked with Gary on Alberta's case, who we did also interview. We are finding things that Gary and Rick didn't investigate at the time. So whether or not if they had investigated it, it would have gone somewhere or if it would have changed their theory, I think that we're maybe raising those questions. But, you know, it's difficult at this point for us to say, you know, how that would have impacted his theory or his investigation. That's something that we're going to talk to him about again in the final episode, though, because so much of what we've done after, I think, episode 4, you know, we've touched base with him, but he's actually learning about it like everyone else is who's listening to the podcast. So in episode 6 that's out tomorrow, for example, we're chasing down this rumor, essentially story that we heard about Alberta being seen in another city the day after Gary and Rick believed that she had disappeared and the day after they believed she had been killed. So if it was true, it would mean that Alberta would have still been alive on the Saturday. And that's something that Gary will, when the podcast comes out, he'll be learning about for the first time. So we're definitely going to check in with him at the end of the podcast, as well as some of the other things that we've been able to pull out of the notebooks and continue to investigate, even though it's been 27 years that they didn't seem to take a closer look at the time.
Now, is there something that you're hoping audiences will take away from this podcast? You know, I know that it's important to you to continue to raise awareness about the stories of these missing and murdered Indigenous women. I think that your history of, you know, what happened in Canada with your Indigenous population and the residential schools has been really fascinating. It's actually, I think, for me, built some empathy for people that we might otherwise just regard as violent. What else are you hoping people will take away, just aside from those, you know, very fundamental things that you've talked about in the podcast?
I think the big thing for us in all of our reporting on missing and murdered Indigenous women has been to, you know, tell the single story of a woman in a way that humanizes these stories, because so much of the reporting, it focuses on the sheer volume, the 1,200 or the 4,000 number. And it's just so important to know that every single one of these women had a family and a community that loved them, that they left behind, and who still mourn their death. And I think that, you know, we haven't heard these stories for so long in Canada or anywhere. And so I think that what's so important to me was to give Alberta's family and friends the space to talk about her as a person and to tell and share with us, you know, who she was and show just how much she's loved and still missed, even though it's been 27 years. Like, this is not something that's gone away for them.
Connie Walker, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to me about Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams. I'm really, really enjoying the podcast, and I cannot wait to hear what happens next.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Missing and Murdered, the podcast opens right out of the gate with a great source, and that's a cop. You know, it made me realize that Serial didn't even have a cop. Laura, I'd love your take on this. What did you think about the fact that it turns out the source that brought Connie the story was a retired cop named Gary? What do you think of him? What do you think of him being the primary source for the story?
You know, it kind of surprised me because I feel like police officers don't generally come forward in a case like this, especially a case they've worked on if it's still open. So I was a little bit in the beginning, I was like, this guy, I wasn't so sure like how credible he was going to be, because it just seemed like it seemed odd to me. But then as he got going, I'm like, this is, you know, it's amazing that he was willing to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously he's still that invested in the case. But, you know, I could tell as it was going on, there's certain things he didn't want to talk about, because he wanted to maintain the integrity of the investigation, because it was still an open case. So I think that, you know, having somebody like that, that actually has some chops behind them coming forward with this information, is definitely, you know, a really good jumping off point, as opposed to somebody, you know, we've all gotten calls from people that have some big story to tell us, and you're like, really?
No, you don't.
yeah. So, you know, I thought it was great, and I think it's really interesting as the series goes on that they're starting to uncover things that he may not have known about.
Right. Now, Kevin, you have talked to retired investigators about cases they worked and didn't solve, but typically they don't want to still go on the record with what it is that they may know.
Yeah, this is true. And I guess he's retired, right? He's still not.
He's retired.
Not with the Mounties, but an invaluable resource.
Right.
You know, no doubt. I mean, not only just he was the spark that got this podcast investigation going, but, you know, he definitely has, you know, years worth of experience and knowledge in the case, and has done a lot of the interviews already, and so it certainly gives a starting point for Connie.
Now, Toby, you've long been wanting to hear a podcast that dives into a larger social issue. And this one really brings it. And we even have an Indigenous reporter telling the story of this larger story of thousands and thousands of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Yeah. But I'd love to hear your take. I mean, this larger story, she brings in the residential school. She brings in her own personal story of violence in her own family and the origin story of that. Given all of that, you know, is this why you love this podcast, Toby?
Yeah, I think so. Although I don't want to sort of downplay the sort of other parts, her reporting, the crime investigation, things like that. But I do think the way you can generalize between the United States and Canada, but the way Native Americans / Indigenous people, and particularly women, have been treated in both countries, you know, it's sort of is beyond abysmal. It's really pretty shocking. And I think that if people knew more, I think there would be more outrage about it. So I think that's one of the things that I like about this is, you know, I thought it was an interesting choice that she took somebody who clearly is not part of what may be a serial killer or several serial killers working in that area and targeting Indigenous women. And at first I was I kind of wondered if that was the right choice, but kind of seeing how it's played out a little bit and sort of the insight you get into the culture, I think it does make sense. And I didn't realize this. I had done some research probably about a dozen years ago into Indian schools in America. And I was looking at a place called the Carlisle School, which was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the late 1800s. And it was the same, you know, it sounded like the same basic idea of the ones in Canada, which is that they would take Native American kids and basically, I think the quote is, kill the Indian to save the man.
That's right.
So they would try and take that culture away from them and turn them into essentially, you know, white Americans. And just that the death rates were super high. So then to find out that this was going on as late as the 1960s.
School was shut in 1996, I believe she said.
Yeah, because there is right now, there was actually a news story in the paper today about there's a $1.3 billion class action lawsuit against the Canadian government for what they call the 60s scoop, was when they took a lot of these kids away from their parents.
Remember, that's Canadian dollars too.
That's right. Yeah. So it's more like 1.13. And you know, the government's fighting it, saying that while we wouldn't do it now, that in fact it was acceptable for the laws as they were then.
Yeah. We wouldn't do it now that you have lawyers.
Right.
And awareness.
Yeah. Awareness.
So and then it just as far as Indigenous women go, you know, between I think it was 1975 and 2015, you know, in the United States, reservation authorities did not have authority over non-Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be a white man living on a reservation with a Native American wife and basically do whatever you want to her,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there was no authority. It was basically carte blanche. They do know that there were serial both killers and serial sexual assaulters who took advantage of the fact that they knew that there was no jurisdiction over
them.
Yeah,
they could go to a reservation and commit crimes.
And it wasn't until 2015 that there was authority given for crimes committed on reservations by Caucasians. One of the objections was, you know, if you have a white guy who gets caught for this, he should have a jury of his peers. And the thought was, you know, having a bunch of Native Americans on a jury would not be his peers.
Right, right. It just brings up the
insanely racist.
It also just brings up the like crazy, crazy world of the fact that these reservations exist at all. I mean, it's an insane system that we set up just to sort of marginalize an entire group of people. And a novel I'd recommend, by the way, that speaks to a lot of these issues is The Roundhouse by Louise Ehrlich.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing novel about a crime committed against a Native American woman on reservation and the legal stuff around it. It's just wonderful, wonderful, beautifully written book. Laura, we just heard Toby say that, you know, he and his head, and I think mine did too, initially sort of went to our serial killers at work here. But mm-hmm. she's sort of telling a bigger story about patterns of violence in the community, sort of, and I think she draws the line from the residential schools and the marginalization to those patterns of violence. What do you think about this huge, huge number of murdered and missing Indigenous women? Thousands is what Connie just told me in that interview there.
That's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable when you hear her talking about how, you know, when she was initially trying to pitch stories about this, they said, oh, what another sad Indian story or whatever. And it's just, you know, I don't know what the, you know, the climate was that allowed this to go on without anybody really, it doesn't sound like anybody really was going to do anything about it. So it's really awful to hear about. And, you know, when I'm listening to this and thinking, you know, she chose to tell this story as opposed to, say, like a, you know, a serial killer or multiple murders, I like this better because I feel like she's really taking us inside a very small community where everybody knows everybody, or, you know, there's a lot of people that are related. It's a very small town. And you really start to get the sense of how small it is as she's going along. Like she's trying to find somebody. Oh, well, they're here with me. Why don't you come over? And they didn't tell you about this. So it seemed to me like, as I'm listening to this, the people within that community, I think, know what happened. But I don't feel like, for whatever reason, that has really been brought out to a point that they could get resolution in this case.
Now, Kevin, there's a lot of transparency in this podcast, and I'm wondering how well you like it, because Connie's a TV reporter, and that's her, you know, that's her regular work that she does is TV reporter. I think we hear a lot of TV reporter stuff.
Well, she has a photog with her.
A photog, she's in a van. You know, really, it sounds more like the work you used to do, that practice of sort of waiting outside somebody's house till they get home.
Yeah, there is a lot of transparency in it. I will just say, sometimes it seems a little pedantic with, you know, going on and on about like how you're waiting and stuff like that. It informs, but it doesn't entertain always.
Right.
But I do.
Wait, are you talking about the transparency where she's talking to her editor? Or are you talking about the transparency where she's just going through the waiting for the guy?
I like the fact that we hear about, you know, they talk to the editor about this. Can we just go and sort of bum rush standards and practices?
I love that stuff.
You know, they're very comfortable saying, look, there was a problem with this audio. You know, I'm thinking back the day where they're hanging out at Jack Little's house, and, you know, it's a whole day of waiting for him. Nothing was happening in real life, so nothing was really happening in that part of the episode.
Right.
And, you know, it didn't seem sort of dramatic or tense.
But then we do hear her, like, ambush him the way that TV reporters do. Have you ever done that to anybody?
Yes.
How's it feel?
Not good.
Scary?
And I did it in Alabama. And I didn't know, and this is the standards and practices thing, I didn't know what the state law was on that. I had to walk into a restaurant with cameras rolling, and I never do that. But it was kind of like, we sent your ass to Alabama, Flynn. You're going to go in, and you're going to walk out with that. So I do appreciate a lot of what the reporting is. Can we just talk about, like, the murderer is beep beep?
Yeah, I was going to go there next, because that was the initial conceit, was that she didn't want to say the name, and she said why. And granted, we listened to this.
But then does it in episode 3.
She does it in the same episode. She talks about who was his name is included in the same episode in which she beeps out his name as a suspect.
Sure. And I was in the car with you and I heard beep beep, and then I heard the name Jack Little. I'm like, that's it. It was two short beeps. It wasn't Jebediah just Nekasekovitz, you know. It was like the beep was too short.
You did call it. You called it right away. Mm-hmm. As soon as she was naming the people at the table, you knew it was Jack Little, that his name had been beeped out. What'd you think of that?
That is, of all the podcasts that we've listened to, that is a differentiator right there, because to actually name names.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot here that, you know, when we talk about Canadian libel law and Canadian standards of professional conduct for journalists, you know, it's obviously very easy to just record a telephone call in Canada. There's no, like, federal wiretap issues. That was surprising, you know, and they'll say, you know, he hasn't been charged with a crime and whatnot. But, I mean, it's pretty clear that that's, at this point in our story arc, that that's who we're supposed to be looking at.
Right.
This individual. That, you know, I don't know what to make of that.
Right.
I mean, it's obviously that's where you want to go and look at them. But guys, I don't know. What do you think when you hear that, okay, here's a guy and we're going after him?
I was kind of surprised. You know, I wanted to know who it was, but I was also kind of cringing a little bit because I was like, ooh, that wouldn't fly here. You know, it definitely, it made me a little uncomfortable. But then, I mean, she did give him an opportunity to respond. You know, then his lawyer wouldn't even talk and said, you know, leave him alone, basically cease and desist. But it definitely made me a little uncomfortable.
I liked what she was saying to him when she was giving him the opportunity to respond, that she was saying, we are doing the story and it would be better with you in it. That's the right thing to say. It's the honest thing to say.
That's what you said, yeah.
Right. Toby, what were you going to say?
What about what she's doing wouldn't fly in the U.S.?
Well, you couldn't. I don't think you could come out and say who somebody, the name of a suspect like that in a case that was ongoing.
Well,
in the way that she's doing it. Well, maybe you could. I
feel like we see that stuff all the time.
No, I think you could. I mean, she's.
I guess you could.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
to catch a predator, that's all that is.
Right. I mean, I think what she's doing, because the one thing that's interesting to me, too, is that she's also looking at people that aren't Jack Little.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's going out. The net is being cast a little bit wider now, which is looking at alternative stuff that the cop didn't think to look at.
I mean, my sense of it is that if you're going to do the podcast the way she's going to do it, it's inevitable that you're going to have to say the name. Like, if you're really investigating this case, using the detective's, you know, initial nudge in the right direction, I mean, how do you do it without naming names?
Yeah, Toby, you're right.
I think you can't do the podcast without doing that.
And I think this would be a very different podcast if it wasn't Prince Rupert and it was Portland, Oregon.
Right.
I think, well, you know, the mysterious land of Canada that a lot of us U.S. citizens have been Googling for the past couple of weeks, those rules are different. And so we are hearing something, it's like when we were listening to Bowerville.
She's taking us to a place we wouldn't otherwise go.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will say that the small town, the small little fishing town.
Prince Rupert.
On the Pacific Ocean, it's a stone's throw from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, that far up on the coast there. It has the feeling, even on the podcast, the audio radio thing, it has the feeling of being really isolated.
Right.
And small, you know, and it's like, oh, it's fishing down into the cannery and everything, and the one place is Popeyes, but everybody also
it's
knows
like
Canadian
it's Bogies. Twin Peaks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not like, I mean, there are like islands in that area where it is, I mean, literally igloos where
right.
people are living in. And I know that we're four white Americans talking about race relations in other countries. And so this is our experience and that we're putting on other cultures here. But
this is your experience.
This is our view. Right. I mean, what I'm saying is don't tweet at us. We get it. We're assholes. Okay. But it just, you know, I think that the setting and the Highway of Tears is a backdrop. It makes it more different than if it were happening in Edmonton or Ontario, somewhere else in Ontario. Or
right.
Whatever.
So here's, can we just get back to the name for a second?
Yeah.
Here's why it's okay for me. She named all the people who were there that night, which you would expect somebody who was reporting the story to do, right? People who were at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like her sister and her friend and her boyfriend and her uncle, Jack Little, and whatever. And there is no way to tell the story while continuing to beep the name of somebody who is also a character in that thread. That you have multiple people saying they saw them together later in a truck. As a listener, you would draw that conclusion. And that's what the cop told her his theory was. So she's now like following the trail that she's been given by a former member of law enforcement who's demonstrating some integrity and not wanting to disrupt the investigation. You know, it is interesting that he didn't want to say the manner of death when it had been reported elsewhere, as we heard Connie say. Kevin, what did you think of that? Do you think it was because the manner of death is evidentiary in nature?
Yeah, there's something about the manner of death. And it leads me to, I guess I could look it up. I'll just admit I haven't Googled what Alberto Williams' manner of death. We know the cause of death. The manner of death is homicide. The cause of death, we don't know, whether it's strangulation or shooting or a combination of things. Just to describe it as, you know, it just, your mind cannot stop wondering what nefarious way it was, by the way they've described it. And the only thing that, you know, I can glean is that if there are 40 plus missing women, murdered women along the Highway of Tears, there's the signature of that killing is different from the rest.
Now, Laura, are you caught up in this podcast?
I am, yes.
All right. What do you think of a witness or suspect that refuses to surrender their DNA when asked, when being questioned about a crime like this? And what do you think of Connie's producer swiping that cigarette butt?
Well, that was interesting. You know, it makes you feel like you should be suspicious of him, but he may just be somebody who's like, you know, I'm innocent and I shouldn't have to do it. I kind of thought it was great when she stole the cigarette butt because
it reminded me of you, actually. I could imagine you doing that.
No, I'm just having a Nick fit.
Yeah, no, I didn't take that. You know, that's what I love with, you know, like we were talking about before, the transparency and the reporting. I love all these little behind the scene things that are happening. And I could really relate when she was sitting out there and she was getting nervous about having to wait for Jack to come home. And, you know, we've all probably, I mean, I can't speak for others, but I know I was very nervous when I've had to call family members of a victim. And, you know, you have to kind of steel yourself up for those things. So whether or not that cigarette butt yields anything.
How could it? I mean, they don't have a lab back at the office.
They're not following proper evidentiary protocol. They are putting it in the bag it and tag it. So, but it was still kind of fun.
But the fact that the cops 2 years ago, whatever, originally asked for a DNA sample tells me that they have some sort of evidence from the crime scene to compare the DNA with.
Right.
I don't think they're just randomly asking
but
for
DNA.
But is
Connie bringing them
I don't
butt
think
going to help with that?
Well, no, it's not going to help. No, I mean, even if they tested it, and again, you know, they don't have maybe that sample. And, well, in the U.S. anyway, they couldn't the prosecution couldn't introduce that as evidence that a reporter stole a cigarette. You know, the chain of custody is all crazy. Laura would have a field day with that, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it would never go anywhere. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, first of all, how many people have touched it? How much transfer DNA? How did they carry it? Where did they put it? I mean, it's yeah. But it still was kind of a fun little feature.
And even just, she even said, the most it could probably prove is that they were together that night. You know, unless, you know, she was found with, you know, a weapon protruding from her body and his DNA is all over that weapon. I don't see how the DNA, you know, how that cigarette butt could actually help.
Toby, do you have any unanswered questions as you're listening to Missing and Murdered, things that you're hoping she'll get to as she's telling the story?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think, you know, obviously it'll be interesting to see how far she gets into actually determining what happened. But I think, you know, and I think she's done a really good job of this so far, but I think tying in whatever the conclusion happens to be, or even if they don't get a conclusion, but tying that in to social issues concerning Indigenous people up there, or just generally the way that crimes against Indigenous people are either investigated or not. If you go on Google Maps and take a look at this Highway 16.
Oh, I did.
I mean, it's crazy remote.
Yeah.
The idea that 40 women, I mean, it's got to be a pretty, like, outsized percentage of the female population. I mean, these are tiny little villages.
Right, in the woods just seem to go on for ever.
You've got that, and then you've got this huge population of, you know, depending on who you believe, 1,200 to 4,000 or, you know, probably more women who've been killed, and it's ongoing. And I guess in Canada, it gets more press, but it's outrageous.
Well, it sounds like we're all really interested in this story. Toby, good call recommending that we listen to it. And thank you for hooking me up with Connie. She was wonderful. Toby was the one who did that little like connection there, and I really appreciate it. But
thanks for pulling your weight, Toby.
It's about time I did something.
I'm going to go around the horn, though, and just kind of get your thoughts. Missing or murdered? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways?
Are we voting for missing or are we voting for murder?
It's not like that. Missing and murdered, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways. Will you continue to listen? Laura Bricker, I'm going to start with you.
I will. You know, it started a little slow for me, but once it you know, I got into the fourth and fifth and sixth episode, I was just like, okay, I was binging on it. So I'm eager.
Actually, Laura, I have a question for you along those lines, because this is something that came up when Kevin and I were listening. I don't think these podcasts necessarily are designed for binge listening. You know what I mean? Do you think that it puts them at a disadvantage when a person listens to six episodes in a row? Isn't it bound to have pacing issues when you're listening to that much content all at once?
I don't know. For me, that's sometimes how I have to do it. So I do end up listening to them all in a row because, you know, I have to be in a, I can't do anything else when I'm listening, or I completely lose what I've been listening to. So if I have a quiet time and I've got my headphones on and I'm listening, I'll just keep listening to the next episode.
All right. So thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways. What did you say?
Thumbs up.
All right. Great. Toby, what about you? What are your thoughts thumb wise about Missing and Murdered?
Well, I think obviously I give it a big thumbs up. It checks off a lot of the boxes of what I look for in a true crime podcast. Yeah, I'm looking forward to 2 weeks when the next one comes out.
What about you, Kevin? Thoughts?
Thumbs up. That's all I got to say. Thumbs up. Can't wait to hear the end of it.
All right. Big thumbs up for me, too. And also, loved Connie. What a lovely, lovely person. TV reporters, I don't know. She's got a lot of depth. I think that CBC knows what they're doing.
Oh, stop now.
No. I'm not saying, but you know, a lot of TV reporters
don't
have the chops to write 6 hours worth of great content.
Some of them are there because they look good on camera.
Some of them are there because they won a pageant and got a scholarship.
I will have to say that sometimes.
Like Kevin? What was your talent?
I was
the
pretty face. I was the eye candy for my TV station, obviously.
No, I thought you meant you were in the beauty pageant.
Mr. Stratford County.
Yes, that's what I was.
No, we know a lot of really, really great TV reporters.
We do. Smart people.
Some of them
people.
Listen to this podcast. Yeah. You know?
Some of them do.
I know.
And some of
and
them
now
would agree.
Alienated
yes,
them.
Right.
No,
they're the smart ones, obviously. But
no.
They would agree. They would agree that there are a couple of pageant groups. And sometimes pageant anchorman?
Yes. TV you know? Reporter friends who might be listening to this podcast, I'm not talking about you. I promise.
No, if they're real TV people, they know it's not bullshit. They know it's not them, but they know who in the newsroom it is.
Yeah, no, and I really just, I like the depth. I like the way that it sounds. I'm just really digging it. Looking forward to hearing the rest of it. So now it's time to move on to my favorite part of this podcast, a little something I like to call the crime of the week. The police in Anchorage, Alaska are seeking a master of martial arts. Surveillance video captured a man dressed as a ninja breaking into a store and stealing, what else? A ninja sword. Seems the crook decided to go full-on crouching tiger hidden dragon when breaking into the comic book store to take the katana sword. He can't be identified because of his black hood and mask, of course.
She's wearing the whole ninja outfit.
This sword, by the way, is the only item he took. Detectives are asking for the public's help in reporting any other unusual ninja activity. So, panel, a ninja stealing a ninja sword is a pretty literal crime. Can you think of any other would-be criminals stealing something so very obvious? Laura, I'm going to go to you first.
This is a tough one. I really can't. The only thing that came to mind when I was thinking about this was police breaking into a donut shop.
Oh, my God.
But I just my brain isn't really functioning this week.
What about you, Toby?
I think I have no choice but to say the Beetlejuice guy stealing a Zagnut bar.
Nicely done.
Very good, Toby.
Call back, too.
Yes.
Call back. What about you, Kevin?
Okay. Well, I will say, just in real life, I remember reporting a guy named Ronald McDonald breaking into a Wendy's.
That. I remember that.
You do, right? See, I'm not full of BS. I think if you were to catch somebody dressed as Frodo breaking into a jewelry store and stealing a ring.
Uh-huh.
Pretty good. Or somebody named Colonel Mustard being caught stealing a candlestick from a conservatory.
What about a stripper robbing the dollar store?
Rebecca for the win.
All right, we should probably end it on that note. Laura Bricker, if our listeners want to find you online and tweet their commiseration for your unending illness, how can they find you on Twitter?
At Laura Bricker.
And Toby Ball, if our listeners want to commend you on your Beetlejuice Zagnut callback, how can they find you on Twitter?
At Toby Ball, NH.
All right. Toby's got an entourage.
What about you, Kev? One of our listeners want to tweet to you.
Hold on, let me get the...
Teddy, come down here.
I am by myself. Okay, it's at Kevin P. Flynn.
And if you want to send me a tweet or follow me on Instagram, you can find me at Reb Lavoie. You can find us on Twitter at Crime Writers On. You can email us your questions and voice memos at crimewriterson@gmail.com. Sign up for our newsletter. Buy stuff using our Amazon link at crimewriterson.com. Review the show on iTunes, especially if you love it. And before you close your podcast app, check out our sister show, These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast. You should also check out the Disappearance Podcast and Death Cast. Our very handsome line producer is Henry Lavoie. Our theme music was performed by the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble and used with their permission. This show was recorded in Studio C at Partners in Crime Media.
This show.
AKA the high-tech studio we keep in a closet in our basement. These credits were recorded live during our taping, and on behalf of all the crime writers, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you later.
Later. Can we
I
do
know you will.
Before we start? Can we do sock club?
Because yes.
Before we forget it.
Yes.
Okay.
Sock club.
Sock club. Sock club.
This is what I'm going to say. I'm going to say this holiday season. Go. Wait. Is this?
Are we doing it for real? Or are you just rehearsing?
I'm reading what it says. That doesn't really.
Tell us when it's real.
Okay. So I'm going to say today we're brought to you by.
No, you're going
to
say it. You actually. Is I'm going to.
Yeah, I'm only going to say it. This episode is brought to you by.
Sock club.
Was that it?
No, that's it. That's the instruction for everybody.
Yeah, that wasn't it.
That wasn't it. No, that's good.
That was about as much emoting as I can.
That's
do.
A lot of emoting.
Okay.
And just the two of you, just like when you
lean
do that.
Lean way back from your mic.
Yeah, you got to lean back from your mic because you're going to be
way
yelling.
Back.
Okay,
way
ready?
Back.
Mm-hmm. And then that's all you have to say. Ready?
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by
Sock Club.
This holiday, give Sock Club!
Sock Club!
They provide a little gift with a big impact that is sure to make you look like an expert gift giver. Each package includes quality American-made socks, a customizable gift message, and a printable membership certificate, so all you last-minute shoppers are covered too. Just for listeners of Crime Writers On,
Sock Club
is offering 15% off subscriptions. So go to
SockClub.com
and use code CRIME at checkout. Give SockClub
Sock Club.
This holiday season.
Promo code CRIME.
Partners in crime media.